All right, ladies and gentlemen, back today. We're going to be talking about Africa today. We've got Martin A. Klein. He's an Africanist and an emeritus professor at the History Department of University of Toronto, specializing in the Atlantic slave trade and Francophone West Africa. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well.
So let's start right off. There's a lot going on in the news and about coups in Africa. Can you talk a little bit about the background of the coup that happened in Mali?
The start of the coup, the background of the coup is Mali is a country that was put together it's a combination of an area which is partly agricultural. It's heavily Muslim in both parts. The most of the land in Mali is desert. Probably 95% of the population lives in agricultural areas, not necessarily well watered. But they're farmers, and there has been over the last 2,000 years a lot of conflict between the farmers and the pastoralists, and both groups are Muslim. Though in the period after independence, there was an increase in conflict, and there was a period of warfare in the 60s right after independence. So some of it is that you have a situation in which the agriculturalists are better educated. The agriculture, the farmers themselves may not be better educated, but there is a very competent, very well educated elite, and I like Mali. The regime that took power at independence was a left wing, quite left wing, one of the more left wing, and. From the first time I visited Mali, one of the things I liked about Mali was that they were serious. They then had a period of military rule, and the military was forced out by really a civilian revolution in the early 90s, and a very able group of people. In the 60s, the civilians prevailed because they were politically more astute. They had good political ties with Algeria, with Morocco, and they then had a period of conflict in the 90s, and again, they settled their problems through negotiation. There are stages in this, and I hope I'm not going to be confusing. Because the settlement in the 90s was essentially a very good settlement. They took many of the they took into the army many of the leaders of many of the educated officers. They promoted many officers from the desert tribes, and that really worked well. I thought that was if I did research in Mali during that period, I had students who did research in Mali, and it was a democratic progressive government. There also was a certain amount of corruption, not in the beginning, and there also was when Gaddafi fell, one of the complicating things was that Gaddafi recruited soldiers from the states of the Sahel, Mali and Niger. And when Gaddafi fell, many of the two things that happened. One is that there was a civil war in Algeria. I hope I'm not being too complicated.
No, this is understandable. So, go ahead. Go on. What was the second part?
There was a civil war in Algeria in which the radicals, when they were pushed out by the Algerian army, and they took root in Mali, a group that became known as Al Qaeda in the Maghreb. And they were very, very small, and they actually weren't that eager to get involved in conquest. But they overlapped with a group that led Libya, and often carried Libya was quite wealthy because it was an oil country, and they had some sophisticated weapons, and they took their high powered weapons with them. And so you ended up with two groups, actually more than two groups, but essentially but a group that was interested in forming a desert state, which would have been ludicrous. I mean, they would have had almost no revenue or no way of getting, even if they found the oil was not in
exports,
in Mali,
export some sand, that's about all.
They wouldn't have been, what they found anything under the sand, they wouldn't have been able to get it to market. But they looked at they looked down on the agriculturalist. It's old-fashioned racism.
Yeah.
And it wasn't racism. One of my students did a brilliant book on the history of race in the area. And he argued strongly that it wasn't something the French taught them. Not that the French weren't racist.
Sure, sure.
It was something they thought up all by themselves.
So
they think of themselves as white, though if they tried to get on a bus in the United States in the 1960s, they would have been seen as black. Okay, if they walked down Street in Toronto or wherever you're based, people would see them as black, but they weren't black. And they defined themselves as racially superior. And they gave this a religious definition. They defined this in terms of descent from the Prophet Muhammad, and et cetera, and so forth. I can go on. Yeah. I can give a separate lecture on that.
But do these groups that are in West Africa, what's the contention about? Can they think they're better than each other?
In the Mali case, the French intervened after this rebellion, and they were successful because the rebels were divided. The more recently, and I must confess, I'm not as well informed recently as I was by the event in about 2012. The soldiers, there've been a number of coups, and the basis of the coups is that Malian governments have generally tried to keep the army weak. And the army has suffered numerous defeats. They've been compounded by the fact that some of the army officers have gotten training from the Americans, and the Americans insist they're training them and they're indoctrinating them in democratic values. Soldiers, particularly soldiers who've suffered defeats, that they've lost on the field of battle, the army has had one negative, it's a disaster after another. And that's the basis of the latest coup. And the putschists, the people who are responsible for the coup, asked the French to leave, and because the French had pushed a return to civilian rule, and they then invited in the Wagner Group, which is most of these coups. I don't know what's going to happen in Gabon, but in Niger, they've invited. Niger is, but I don't know. The Wagner Group is not in Niger yet, but they've talked about linking.
Yeah.
In Mali and Burkina Faso, and I don't know much about what's happened. The ideology, the various ideologies, both even nationalist or religious, Salafist Islam,
Is this really typical of stuff that happens in that region, though? I mean, how many coups have we gone through in the last 100 years in Africa?
In Africa?
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't count them. In Mali, there's been 1, 2. There's been probably about a half a dozen coups or attempted coups.
Are they all similar in characteristics as far as the groups involved, or are they different?
No, because there's a series of issues, and they relate differently. There is the religious issue, the Al Qaeda in the Maghreb. There is the nationalism of the Tuareg pastoralists who want their own state, regardless of how, and in spite of the fact that they were given good terms, and there was a big settlement in 95, and they're the soldiers who complain that the civilians aren't giving them the aid they need. And they're hostile to the French, which doesn't mean that they're left wing. they've turned to in Mali, they've turned to the Wagner Group, and they've also and because they one of the problems they have is that the desert, the nationalists have tried to infiltrate pastoral groups within the agricultural zone, and they've extended their activity. There's not that much activity in Senegal, and I don't even know if there's much in Mauritania. The Mauritania is very strongly Muslim.
How many religious groups are we talking in that region?
Well, you're talking about Islam.
Well, this is one religious group. How many others are around? I mean, I'm assuming there's some Christians.
Yeah, but the Christians aren't militarily important.
Okay,
the Muslims. Yes, Senegal and Mali. Islam south of the desert. The spread of Salafist ideology has been limited, and in Senegal has a long tradition. I mean, the 19th century there was a lot of warfare, a lot of religious warfare, but under French rule, it's actually not based in French rule. Senegal is an amazing country because it's the more dynamic Islamic groups. Do you know anything about Islam, Sufism?
No, is that one? Is that the radical Sharia law one? Caliphate. So
they all want Sharia law, but it's what kind of Sharia law?
Extremely conservative, I suppose.
Well, in Senegal, there are a couple religious leaders who there are a series of wars in the 19th century, and the. My first book was on Islam and imperialism in Senegal, and the group that became ascendant in the period before and after the conquest were groups that believed that the best way to spread Islam is by the jihad of the mouth. You know, you spread it orally. You teach that warfare is not successful.
Yeah.
Where are you based? Where are you?
I'm in Germany.
Oh, you're in Germany.
Yeah.
I don't know if the German the Senegalese. Do you have Senegalese peddlers?
Oh yeah, sure.
That's them.
Yeah,
they're very. The police in New York like them because they don't get involved in shooting people or dealing in drugs. They're in the United States. If I see a large black man, selling things any place in the world, Istanbul, Paris, I address them in Wolof and they answer me in Wolof. This is an intriguing development because they start off as a peasant group. And they've been since the 90s. This is only one group, but 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 by and large, the dominant ideologies, there's right now not any significant religious conflict. I don't mean they don't argue with each other, and the Catholic.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a cardinal now. The Catholics get along with them because the Catholics are a minority, and the Muslims are tolerant of the Catholics, and it all works out well. In Mali, because of the way things have evolved, particularly since the middle of the last century, there has been conflict, and the other thing is that the army in Mali has been hostile to civilian rule, has been a lot of intersecting conflicts.
So what
they turn to the Wagner Group because they themselves are very weak.
Yeah, they're hiring out mercenaries. How often does it happen that Western powers or Western, Northerners get involved in these kind of conflicts in Africa?
Oh yes, well, resources. The Americans get involved for economic reasons, but mostly for geopolitical reasons. And the French get involved because their interests, they have interests that date back to colonial rule. And the original French involvement after the warfare in 2002, one of these groups, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, wasn't strong enough to threaten. They had an ideology. They gave training, but there were only about 800 of them. And one of the nationalist groups started a march on Bamako. The French had 5,000 French citizens in Bamako, and the French intervened militarily and pushed the Malians back, and pushed this desert movement back. The problem is that the desert people are militarily more effective than the Malian army.
Why is that?
And they're better soldiers.
Rough conditions.
They know how to fight in the desert. And in fact, when you start getting coups and counter coups, the people who come to power often aren't that very effective militarily, and yet they blame the civilians, probably with some basis, for not giving them the support, the weapons, in particular the training they need.
Yeah.
And right now it's hard for me to get information. I mean, for 10 years ago, I was doing a lot of lecturing on the situation, because I could call friends of mine. The guy who wrote the book on racism was an undergraduate student of mine. Now it's almost impossible. There used to be a music festival, a festival of the desert. And Mali produces great music, fantastic music. And they had this festival in the desert north of Timbuktu. And now it's not really safe.
Oh man!
I mean, people get kidnapped. People have been animals get killed. They are, but they get held for ransom and often held under conditions that aren't particularly nice.
That's a shame. I mean, where does Fela Kuti come from?
Fela Kuti, he's Nigerian.
Oh, he is. Okay. Oh,
he's a great musician.
Great music. Really great.
But Nigeria, we'd have to do a complete session
on
Nigeria.
Yeah.
Nigeria is totally different. And Nigeria hasn't had a coup in years.
Yeah.
They've had more coups probably than any other country. But right now, they haven't had a coup. Oh, I don't remember when the last coup is, but at least 20 years.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question about you taught in Kinshasa for a year, is that right?
Yeah.
What was that like?
My wife hated it. Well, she had two kids.
That's rough.
Martin,
what were you thinking?
Actually the kids were part of the reason I wanted to go back to Africa while the kids were young. And one of the things I didn't realize is that kids are most portable between the age of 5 and 10. When they're in their teens, they don't want to be separated from their friends.
Yeah.
And when they're very young, you have some problems. We didn't have that many problems, but it would have been easier. There was an American couple in the Congo with the nuclear reactor. That in itself is a story, but there was a nuclear reactor in the Congo. We were Americans. We were not Catholic. The university at the time was still Catholic. The Mobutu nationalized it. I mean, Mobutu's a mixed bag, but the Americans were very influential. I was a Fulbright lecturer, and in private conversation with people at the U.S. Embassy, because those were the people who were paying my salary. In private conversation, relations with the army came up over and over again.
Wow.
Well, probably one of the most influential people, what was his name? There was a guy, the major CIA man in Kinshasa, was connected to a diamond dealer.
Oh my God! Of course he was.
It's a man named Templesman.
Wow!
And there was one, you had American politics, which was, I was not, you know, when I applied, one of the brightest students, probably one of the brightest people I ever had, was a Congolese student. And I had applied for several things in Africa, in I had a sabbatical year, and so I decided I wanted to get, and I wanted to get back to Africa. I really like Africa. In fact, I liked a lot of things about the Congo. Some of my students were fantastic, and some of them were not that good, but some of the schools were pretty good then. But Mobutu himself was personally very corrupt. A third of the budget passed through Mobutu's hands. And people thought he estimated his wealth at, I don't know how many billion dollars. He had homes in the Riviera, and I think he had one in Morocco. I was told he had one in Senegal. I don't think he was that wealthy, because I think one of the things that that people like Mobutu have to spend a lot of money to keep power. To make money, they have to spend money. And somebody I knew who was as a student, who came back and was a minister, made a minister shortly after he came back, said when he met Mobutu, Mobutu said to him, "If you have any problems, come to me." You understand what that means.
That's like when the mafia says it to you.
It means don't steal. Yeah. I'll take care of you. And I could, you know, if we were sitting in a bar someplace, I could tell you stories about, I mean, Mobutu distributed a great deal of wealth. And the Americans, he was their boy. He started out as on the payroll of the CIA. The CIA, I don't know who killed Lumumba, but the CIA was probably involved in some way. And when Mobutu broke loose, he was their boy, but he didn't cooperate all the time. And he was not a puppet. He was not stupid. He did some very clever things. In any case, the university was interesting. I had interesting students. I had a mobilette, so I could go into the city to get my mail.
What did you eat during the time? Obviously, you have to eat the local food. What kind of food are you eating down there?
Oh, so the food was. I didn't often get invited to places where they ate. But only one time, I was invited. This African student. Brilliant African student was part of a group. You know, in many parts of Africa, there are people who there are ethnic groups that are favored. That if you're racists, often have a belief that. Whites are smarter than blacks, but some blacks are smarter than other blacks. and in the Congo, it was a group called the Luba. And the Luba, and some of it was that the Luba the Luba went to the best schools. They were from an area that was that Union Minière was involved in, and it and the and there was a group that went, and also it was the Congo under the Belgians, they divided areas between different Catholic religious orders, and this group was people educated at Benedictine secondary schools, and the in the when we were there, there was still a lot of, depending on who you were, there was still a lot of racism. But there was a group of people who came out of Benedictine secondary schools that were really quite brilliant. And oh, this is a long introduction to food. So they had a group of his friends invited my wife and I to dinner. And there was a mound of something that looked a little bit like mashed potatoes, but glutinous. And on the sideboard, and then there was rice or potatoes. I forget what, which, because the belief was that white people like potatoes. The Belgians like potatoes. And
it's true.
I looked at the host, and I said, "Is that fufu?" And they all broke out laughing because I'd never had fufu. Fufu was cassava. I'd never eaten fufu, so I had my first fufu.
Nice.
Fufu is not as good as. You know, I've eaten different. There are different specialties, but in the Congo, in Mali, it's rice. White people like rice, you know. And well, Africans have their stereotypes too.
I can tell. Yeah.
In the Congo, it's potatoes. I mean, and there was a restaurant, a university a faculty restaurant on campus, and they did serve a lot of potatoes. because on the university campus, there's still a lot. The faculty was still, it was about 60% Belgian, about 20% African.
Wow.
You could get European cuisine and certainly it was rice and
well, potatoes will keep you alive. Yeah. That's true. White people love potatoes. Well,
potatoes, vegetables, you know, the missionaries like to eat food from home.
Yeah.
You know, they like to, the missionaries, mission stations were agricultural establishments, among other things. They ran hospitals, they ran schools, they were very more important in the Congo because they controlled most of the education system. And the university which I was teaching at was Catholic. And in fact, one of the problems we had, when I had an African friend who came over to our house, the houses were, you know, there were, you didn't build your own house. You were assigned a house, and there were A houses and B houses and G houses, and a lot depended on your status. And Africans would immediately say that if you were Belgian, you would have had a different kind of house.
Oh my God.
And then they heard that my son would wake up at, I don't know, 6:30 in the morning and cry for a half hour. He was 1 year old.
Yeah.
And he had, and they were delighted because my house was an attached house. We had a common wall with a Belgian man who ran the restaurants and who was quite nasty.
Oh, really?
We had a problem with him and our relations with a servant.
Uh-oh.
And my son was quite popular because the Africans detested this guy. There's so much, right? You know, the Senegal, there were racists in Senegal, but the French, most of the, and some of the Petit Blanc, but by and large, the French knew enough to shut their mouth.
Yeah.
And Senegal had been electing people to office since the mid-19th century. I mean, that's one of the reasons Senegal is such a successful country today. There is a tradition of education, and the Belgians. I don't know how many times I heard Belgium, particularly the Flemish, would say that. I understand the Congolese. I have 10 kids.
This is what
the Belgian prime minister, when they were negotiating independence, he said to the press before he went into the negotiations that I understand these people.
Yeah.
I have children.
Let me.
And you were equating, he was equating Patrice Lumumba to infants. And in fact, this group I spoke of earlier include some of the most brilliant people I've known. I mean, there's no. And some of them would. Actually, I had an argument with one guy because he had he was a linguist, a Flemish linguist, and he was again one of these 10 kids guys, and he was a colleague of mine, and he sent one of his students he sent off to San Diego, and he said it wasn't that the student applied to San Diego and got admitted, and he had another student who was interested in folklore, and I became friendly with this guy, and I said, you know, I said there are places you could apply to in the U.S. because I knew the U.S. That are very strong in folklore, and Van den Eyden, the Belgian, came to me in anger, He said, what business do you have telling my students where to go? I had decided that he would study with Father Stappers, who was a Dutch priest. And I was dumbfounded. This idea that a student did not have a right to seek, that you had to be somebody's protege, was for me, was just what was fun. But I heard so many times this notion that, and not all of the, because some of the Belgians, there were some of them were there because they were anti-racist. They were anti.
That's good.
They were critics.
There's always some, right? You'd hope that there's sometimes, but there's two things I really hate, and one is the racists, and the other one is the Belgians.
I had Belgian. I had a handful of Belgian, including the priest. You know, there was a wonderful guy whose father had been father or grandfather had been a baron under Leopold, but who had become a priest and was a very generous human being. But collectively there were problems with the Belgians and the Congolese knew this. This brilliant student of mine, I asked him once, I don't know how we got into the conversation about Flemish.
Yeah.
He said, I won the Flemish prize in high school, but I've forgotten Flemish. You understand?
Yeah,
his English was, I the thing I admired about him is that his English, 1 year in the U.S., and his English was absolutely immaculate.
Yeah. Well, it's the opposite of the missionary, right? The missionary goes somewhere else.
Your English is probably good because you're German and you've been studying English from the...
No, I'm American.
You're American.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
But German, there's nothing wrong with being American. The Germans... the Dutch are even better than the Germans.
Sure.
But any German under 40 speaks almost... I had a rant in Berlin a couple of years ago, about 10 years ago. And I thought I'd improve my German. But the research institute I was at, everybody spoke English. It operated in English. And mind you, if I addressed somebody in German, they would respond to me in German. But somehow the conversation would get back into English very quickly.
Yeah.
But that's the school system. But that starts very young.
Yeah.
But to have somebody whose English is as immaculate as this guy was, it is still exceptional. Most people operating in their second language or third language, often need help. Yeah. I'm often surprised at people who are fine scholars. They write well, but they need editors.
Mm.
And Andre didn't need an editor. He's just, his language was just so. But the culture was still in the 60s, still so heavily racist. And the Belgians had, the Belgian approach to education was by and large to give primary education. You wanted to educate workers so that you could train them, so that you, so you, they needed basic work, basic French in the 50s, they started improving education at Independence. The press made a lot of, paid a lot of attention to their only 15 university graduates. What the press didn't say is that there had been in the late 50s a dramatic increase in secondary education. Up until the 1950s, there was almost no secondary education. You had a high level of primary education, but almost no secondary. Of those who were educated, i.e. the 15, or the many of them were had majored in one of two fields. Both of them absolutely irrelevant to an independent country. One is theology. Many of them are going to, they didn't all join the church, but they got their education from church schools. And the other was philology. So they, that, and even at Independence, the Belgians were interested in keeping students away from radical ideology, and but in the 61-62, students at there were three universities, but the best was Louvainium, which was created by the University of Louvain in Belgium. And the they were reading things. There was a black market in books. They were reading Frantz Fanon.
Wow.
I mean, Frantz Fanon was very popular. By the mid, by the time we were there in 68, this was somewhat less so. But I had some curious, I had one day I arrived at class a little early, and we were, or maybe the class before was flowing in leaving the room. And I had a student who I had picked out as a radical, but he was always very polite. And he very politely asked me what I thought about the war in Vietnam. And I think I stunned him when I told him. But the first thing, when I arranged to go to, the Americans had this position, and nobody wanted to go there. And when I applied for it, I told the committee that was hiring Fulbright professors that I would not, under any circumstances, defend American foreign policy. This is at the time when the U.S. was, this is 68. you know, and which they assumed meant that I was opposed to the war in Vietnam, and they were used to dealing with people who were opposed to the war in Vietnam. What people in Washington, and then the same thing, I got to the Congo and I said, I will lecture, but I will not defend American foreign policy. And they read that again as I would not defend the war in Vietnam. And in fact, many of these State Department people were probably critical of the war in Vietnam, but that's another point.
Wow.
What they didn't understand, particularly guys who were stationed in Africa, is that what had happened in American universities was an alienation from the United States, from American. And there was in the 60s, there was massive alienation. And when I did, the Americans had an American week once a year in a different city, which turned out my year to be Goma, which has since been a disaster. But then was a rather lovely place.
Yeah.
And again, I said, I'll talk about race in the United States. I'll talk about African history, which I did. And they said, sure, you know. Wow. So I went to Goma. I gave a couple of lectures, and then I gave a lecture in Kisangani.
Wow.
But which Kisangani was sad because Kisangani had been the center of a rebellion in the 65 and 66. And the Americans had an apartment in Kisangani, which I stayed in. One window, one side of the apartment faced on the port, the river port, which was not operational. And the other side faced the main city, the center of City Square, and it was empty. And I don't know what led to us going into the suburbs. There's the suburbs with lots of people, but Kisangani was the city itself was dead. Mm. So many people have been killed. It had been such a disaster.
Look, Sir Martin Klein, we got to end it here. We went over our time by twice because you had so many good stories. Would you come back and do it again with us?
Sure.
You're what?
I love to talk.
I
like to talk. I sometimes forget where I'm going.
You're a global treasure and a wonderful human being, and you've had an incredible academic journey and just crazy stories. I love it.
Yeah. What is your name?
My name's Chris Jeffries.
Chris Jeffries. Okay. I have it down here.
Yeah. So yeah. I'll send you a link when this gets published and stuff, but we'll sit down. Let's do this again sometime. What do you say?
Okay. Not right away because I'm behind on a lot of things.
Okay. All right.
Well, I'm probably in my last major project. I'm 89 years old.
Oh, you look like you're 60.
Yeah, people tell me I look like I'm younger.
Yeah.
But I forget things.
You're young and spry. Anyway,
yeah, give me a little while and I'll do it again.
All right. Well, you're a treasure and a treat, and I really thank you. So let's sign off to everybody in TV land. Bye, everybody. Thanks for coming.
Okay.